It's Wednesday, June 4th, 2025, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And if you know the show, and if not, if you're new, welcome. But if you know the show, what I usually do is I start off with a news item up here, and then we get right into the interview and then the spiel. I'm reversing things today, and I am into very much this news item of spider's web. The Ukrainians came in like a spider's web. You know, I sing so badly that it doesn't actually evoke any copyright violations. Sorry, Miley Cyrus. So I'm going to be talking about that in the spot normally reserved for the spiel. What I'm doing today is a somewhat lengthy introduction of Leah Littman, because over the next 2 days, we will have a two-part interview with this co-host of the Strict Scrutiny podcast. What I wanted to do was give her arguments stricter scrutiny than they've gotten, because I looked it up and Leah Littman's done, by my count, almost 50 podcasts. And it's not as if no one has asked her a hard question, but I do believe that the, 12 questions that I ask her, 10 are the hardest that she gets. Her new book is Lawless: How the Supreme Court Runs on Conservative Grievance, Fringe Theories, and Bad Vibes. And I heard an interview with Preet Bharara and on the A1 podcast on NPR, and some said, how come when the conservatives do it, it's vibes, but when the Warren Court did it, it was something other than vibes? And that's a fair enough question. She has a fair enough answer. What I want you to hear is what they call in the law joint stipulation of facts, laying some of the predicate, because I know that she knows, but I want to know that you know. My contention is that her way of looking at the court, that it's almost purely ideological, which there's a lot of ideology, that it's ideological because rich Republicans wanted to put other Republican thinking justices there. That is true. I mean, Leonard Leo, who apparently Donald Trump has some problems with these days, that's what his whole life effort is. But this is the defining aspect of the court. You've heard me talk about that. I think there's a lot more noise in the data than someone like Littman would have you know. So first of all, we should note that, and this comes up in the interview, 9-0 is the most common kind of decision on the Supreme Court. SCOTUS blog, now owned by the Dispatch, was for many years an independent entity, and they put together great statistics. And from 2010 to 2021, 43% of cases were decided 9-0, by far the most common outcome. Now, if you want to talk about recently, which is most of what Littman's book is about, because her argument is that this is the culmination of a strategy, and now we're just going to get an ideological court and a poorly deciding court too, and I press her a little bit on that, though conservative and with decisions that you wouldn't make, does that mean they're poorly decided? She says yes. I don't know. You'll hear that part of the discussion. But as you know, in the last couple of years, some of the biggest rulings have been exactly those 6-3 rulings, with the three liberals who are powerless to do anything in the dissent saying, no, I think abortion should be kept legal under all circumstances. That's the Dobbs decision. And then, of course, there was the Trump immunity decision, Trump v. the U.S., also a 6-3 vote split along ideological lines. However, and this will come up, and she says, well, all those, or so many of those 9-0 decisions don't really matter, they're procedural. No, there are a lot of 9-0 decisions that are not procedural that actually rebut her idea that it's only ideological, that the court is just reaching for ideology. One was Trump versus Anderson. This was where some states, I think Colorado, kicked Donald Trump off the ballot, and the court, all of them, came in, not ideologically, just looking at the law, and said 9-0 in an important decision, because if it had gone another way, it would have been gigantic, said, no, the people have to decide. There's another decision, the state independent legislature theory, which was 6-3, with Thomas Gorsuch and Alito being the three in the minority who rejected the idea that, well, it's kind of a, I think, crazy fringe theory, but the details of Moore versus Harper were slightly less crazy than all that. But it's an example of a non-ideological decision that was clearly the right decision. Or take, and this is a really weird one, there was a 5-4 decision where Harrington versus Purdue Pharma, the court rejects a bankruptcy plan that would have shielded the Sackler family from civil lawsuits related to the opioid crisis. And the 5-4 was not based on any way that would be predicted by any ideology. Two of the liberals joined the other conservatives. And I would say this is very consequential. Billions of dollars were on the line, not just for the victims, but for states which would have funded opioid recovery programs. In fact, you can argue that in practical terms, many more people are certain to be affected by that ruling than the Trump immunity ruling, which is not just the Trump immunity ruling, that's the presidential immunity ruling. That might not even come into play. I'm not saying it's not an important ruling, but right now it's in the realm of the hypothetical. And then another one of the rulings that she talks about, and we can't talk about everything or otherwise it's a 2 hour or 3 hour interview show, but she does talk a lot about the voting rights cases. And tomorrow in the spiel, I'm going to talk about Shelby County versus Holder because I did a lot of research and I don't know if it was correctly decided, but the consequence of that has been pretty small, actually, surprisingly small, after doing a ton of research into what she considers one of the most consequential decisions. Why? Because it actually had a huge consequence, or it confirms the theory that all these 6-3 conservative opinions are bad opinions that we only got because conservatives were pulling the strings and Leonard Leo was trying to get his people on the Supreme Court. Leonard Leo is, by the way, trying to do that. Trump antagonist as of late, Leonard Leo. I do say this to her, I think that there is a line of jurisprudence that just simply agrees more with where the conservatives are on a lot of these issues. I noticed in the book she didn't bring up the affirmative action case, maybe because twice as many members of the public agree with the court's decision as disagree. So sort of the inverse of the Dobbs decision. So I do wonder, and I ask her this question, how do we know that the ideology at play is mostly that of the court's ideology and not Leah Littman's ideology? Because I think when Leah Littman sees a decision that she doesn't like, sometimes she has excellent arguments. Sometimes she does make a good case that it was poorly decided on the law. But a lot of times, I think it's just an argument that she doesn't like. And it's a confirmation bias where when it's 6-3, that's an important decision that wouldn't have come about except for some chicanery in the background. I am trying to subject this argument to strict scrutiny. I've seen that she's done dozens, literally dozens of podcasts. I haven't listened to all dozen. I've listened to over a dozen of the podcasts, probably closer to 20. And she's, in all of those podcasts, had to contend with one or two semi-challenging questions. Some of the listeners to the NPR program 1A asked her a good question or two. And Preet Bharara asked her a good question on the Stay Tuned with Preet podcast. Well, when you say bad vibes with this court, why, when the Warren Court made its decisions, wasn't that just bad vibes? Fine question, fine answer. But she'll get more scrutiny here, as you will hear from our interview. I wanted to set it up with just some statistics about how the court makes decisions. And this, I think, and I hope, will orient you successfully as you listen to Mike Pesca, Leah Littman, part one, Lawless. Leah Littman is a professor of law at the University of Michigan, a former Supreme Court clerk. I hear her nearly every week on the Strict Scrutiny podcast, a part of the Crooked Media, Pod Save America suite of podcasts. And if you listen to her there, you're probably not going to be shocked to know that she has some critiques of the U.S. Supreme Court. Alito, Thomas, and the gang, mostly the gang, they're put in a new book and juxtaposed with her thoughts on the Barbie movie, Game of Thrones, and If There's Always Money in the Banana Stand, in a new book called Lawless, How the Supreme Court Runs on Conservative Grievance, Fringe Theories, and Bad Vibes. Leah Littman, welcome to The Gist.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I do listen to Strict Scrutiny a lot, and I actually, my media diet is to go there, then to go to Advisory Opinions, and maybe between the two of them, get some synthesis about what to think about recent Supreme Court decisions. But if listeners to my show listen to your show, they wouldn't be surprised to know that there is a lot of criticism of how the court is coming to its conclusions, not even necessarily the conclusions. But what I would like to do, if you would, could you go back to the conservative justices on the court, from Wiser White to Potter Stewart to Rehnquist, who almost spans these eras. And tell me why those conservative justices were, in your opinion, if they were, of a different type or a different ilk or doing something quite different from these conservative justices.
So I actually think of the ones you named, Chief Justice Rehnquist is probably most similar. And he figures pretty prominently in the book because I think he is in a lot of ways the precursor to the modern Republic appointees on the Supreme Court. Justice Rehnquist was one of the dissenters in Roe versus Wade. He was elevated to the position of Chief Justice after he dissented. He is also the author, I think, presumably, of the opinion in Bush versus Gore that had stopped the presidential count in Florida and ordered Florida to certify George Bush as the winner of the presidential election. So I think he is, in a lot of ways, a symbol or stalking horse for what the Republican appointees would become. That being said, you know, he did not do all of the things that the modern Republican appointees are doing, but I think he is quite similar and was a sign of things to come. The earlier nominees that you were identifying are conservative nominees, but I think part of what makes them different is their views are a little bit more heterodox than the modern Republican appointees. Some of what has changed about modern Supreme Court appointments is in part because of partisan polarization, but also because of the focus on the conservative legal movement's judicial selection machine, they've been better able to identify prospective nominees who will more reliably rule in predictable ways.
Right. So in the past, you might get a Republican appointee, I don't know, David Souter, and he turns out to be a reliable left-leaning vote on the court. And Whizzer White was also one of the dissenting votes in Roe v. Wade, but he came to it, you're saying, more honestly and less as a consequence of a concerted effort beforehand to pre-craft what his jurisprudence would be?
Yes, exactly. So in the lead up to Roe, you know, during the period in which Justice White is appointed, it's not like a political party was out there looking for Supreme Court nominees who would say that abortion isn't a constitutional right. But that doesn't describe the judicial selection machine as it has come to exist.
So there are heterodoxies among the justices now, and beyond not every decision being 6-3 or sometimes Roberts' dissents in 5-4, but it's still a conservative majority decision. There are plenty of decisions where the scrambling of the justices wouldn't be predicted by the party of the president who appointed them. How to explain that within the context of your overall thesis, which is that it's a different kind of conservatism, a stamping out of conservatives who will march in lockstep with a predefined ideology?
Yeah, so there are some differences among the Republican appointees on federal Indian law, Native American affairs. Justice Neil Gorsuch differs
from
some of his colleagues.
That's his one big thing, yeah.
That's his jam. And it turns out that Amy Coney Barrett's big jam is whether the president gets to exercise all of the power he wants and then some. So I think there are going to be some issues on which the Republican appointees differ. But my concern is that the media and commentators sometimes overemphasize those, in part because they're just more interesting. You know, from the perspective of a lawyer or a law professor, it's much more fun to talk about cases that don't have an ideological breakdown than it is to talk about the cases that do. Because when they do have that breakdown, then partisanship, politics, and ideology are more of an explanatory focus than legal analysis might be. As to what explains those differences, I think the reality is the Republican Party selected some issues that were more important than others, and those were the issues on which they focused more of their energy to identify prospective nominees. Those are also the issues that they have focused more on their messaging within the conservative legal movement and that ecosystem. So on voting rights, affirmative action, abortion, LGBTQ equality, those bigger ticket issues, as well as the administrative state and the powers of regulatory agencies, those are the issues on which the Republican Party focused and continues to focus. And those are unsurprisingly the issues on which there is the ideological breakdown.
I think the media is mostly focused on the biggest issues, which are often the 6-3, sometimes 5-4 issues. And I would say that Dobbs got a lot more coverage than any of these niche issues on Indian affairs. And I would say the immunity case got a lot more coverage than any of these issues on, you know, more ideologically scrambled decisions.
I think those two decisions definitely got a lot of attention. But if you look at end of term retrospectives and recaps, you will often see emphasis on, well, they didn't divide 6-3 or 5-4 in all of the cases or a supermajority of cases. Instead, look at these interesting breakdowns. And it's in those sort of retrospectives and recaps or even previews that I think the emphasis gets placed on the differences rather than similarities.
If you look at the statistics of what the decisions were, 9-0 is much more common than 5-4 or 6-3. So it's not outside the realm of journalistic responsibility to make that point. It's also within the journalistic responsibility to point out the times that the courts didn't march in lockstep ideologically. I think that those aren't just necessarily little asterisks. It's important for the public to know what the court is really doing and how often they do totally agree, how often there is just one dissent, and how often that one dissent, maybe surprisingly to some, is quirky and not just Alito or Thomas sticking up, digging in his heels, but it can be any one of the justices.
I just think that those numerical and quantitative estimates really skew the perspective on what the Supreme Court is doing. And it's one of the criticisms of the book is that that kind of descriptive way of depicting what the justices are doing can miss how the breakdown changes on the issues that affect more people's lives, the issues that have more of an ideological bent. And so, for example, if you imagine a Supreme Court term where there's 75 patent cases, one case about whether the president can deport people without due process, another case about whether marriage equality is still a thing, another case about whether women can have health care, mm-hmm. another case about whether the Voting Rights Act is still constitutional, another case about whether administrative agencies can exist. Who cares if there are 75 9-0 cases? And I think an opinion breakdown or a term recap that says, look, there are these 75 unanimous cases, oh, and 5-6-3 splits without breaking down the substance of those rulings, I think it gives the public a skewed perspective about what the justices are up to.
How do you know you're not engaged in this skewed perspective of seeing the decisions that you firmly disagree with, which, by the way, I probably do too. And I also disagree in some part with the logic and the reasoning that goes into the decisions. But how do you know you're not ascribing more importance to the really bad 6-3 decisions as opposed to looking at Masterpiece Cake Shop, right, which was a 7-2 ruling, or the Wisconsin case where 7 of the 9 justices ruled that Wisconsin voters couldn't challenge their state's legislative map. There are a whole lot, my point is, there are a whole lot of really, really important cases that aren't decided just the Republican majority.
Yeah, so a lot there, a few.
But you
thoughts.
Think, I mean, so, I'm taking it that you essentially disagree. You think the most important cases are 6-3.
I think the most ideologically salient and the most consequential cases, yes, tend to break down along ideological lines. A few things. One is part of the criteria for what kinds of cases that I think are important are cases that change the law, cases that have the potential to transform the legal landscape and government institutions. And so the decisions that you're pointing to, Masterpiece Cake Shop and whatnot, those moved the law in smaller directions, but didn't do the kind of radical transformation that the major questions doctrine, overruling Roe, ending the Voting Rights Act, and whatnot did.
Now, another thing, I recently heard you on The Bulwark, and you described Neil Gorsuch yelling in court and pounding a fist.
Sure. And also apparently Neil Gorsuch, who read Pride Puppy and had an utter fucking meltdown. So he looked at this book, which
I'm
is a puppy at a
Pride puppy. Is that like someone in a pup mask at a Pride?
No, it's a little dog at a Pride parade. Okay. And teaching kids what you will find at a Pride parade. And Neil Gorsuch looked at this book. There's a woman in a leather jacket. And he was screaming at the top of his lungs at the advocate, why are you letting kids look for bondage and sex workers and BDSM? And the advocate is like, that's a woman in a leather jacket, Neil. So there's that.
But I went back and I listened to what Gorsuch said.
So Pride Puppy was the book that was used for the pre-kindergarten curriculum. That's no longer in the curriculum.
That's the one where they are supposed to look for the leather and things and bondage, things like that.
It's not bondage. Sex, it's a woman and a leather.
Sex worker, right?
No.
No?
That's not correct. No.
I read it.
It's a drag queen.
Drag queen.
The leather that they're pointing to is a woman in a leather jacket. And one of the words is drag queen in the search.
And they're supposed to look for those.
It is an option at the end of the book, correct?
Yeah.
And there was no yelling at all. And
I cannot remember the verb I used, but Neil Gorsuch's tone was, I would describe as irritated. I won't say he's screaming at the top of his lungs. He is agitated and getting irritated with the advocate in a way that I often rib him for.
Okay. So I didn't even hear him say that. And the only reason it matters is the book is a collection and the analysis is a collection of real deep, and I think my listeners can understand the depth of your knowledge, but also humor and pop culture, but also hyperbole. And so I wonder, as someone who, since so much of our conversation was about trying to communicate to the public and giving the public a correct impression of what the Supreme Court was doing, I wonder if you worry or fret over using too much hyperbole in describing what the justices are doing, such that people could come away with a real misimpression of the actual nature and decisions of the court.
I don't. I think the picture I have painted of the Supreme Court is describing a fundamental aspect and core way in which the Supreme Court is operating. As we've been talking about, you know, you can always identify exceptions or departures, either in like the vote breakdown or particular cases as to how they are decided. You know, the differences among the Republican appointees, how you might describe, you know, one passage or another, or like the tone or tenor of a separate writing or a statement at oral argument. But I think that the picture I paint of the Supreme Court captures an important reality that I want people to see in the modern court. And honestly, like courts that preceded it as well, because a lot of the book is also identifying origins for what's happening.
And that's not it. We'll be back with more of Leah Littman and more challenging questions, including what is the cost of describing the Supreme Court not as wrong, not as poorly reasoned, not even as corrupt, but as illegitimate? We'll get back to that and more with Leah Littman tomorrow on The Gist. And now the spiel. Let's call it a spiel. They were hidden in sheds, launched from trucks, snuck deep inside the country by secret operatives. They hit targets over 2,500 miles from the front lines. And the Russian military didn't know what happened. We're talking about $600 drones. And what they did was ensnare the mighty Russian Air Force in the spider's web. That was the name of the operation, which destroyed or significantly degraded a quarter to a third of Russian long-range bombing capacity. It's been called the most successful strategic operation in the history of warfare. I immediately thought of the Israeli pager attack, also a strategic operation that was successful, but that only killed or injured replaceable people in a proxy militia of original power. This one destroyed $100 million aircraft. So I would say the assessment of most successful strategic operation ever is correct. The Telegraph's associate defense editor, Dom Nichols, seems to agree.
Is this the Pearl Harbor moment? Look at Russia's armed forces. The Russian land army has been largely destroyed. The tanks and the infantry fighting vehicles, the personnel carriers. It's going to take, pluck a number, five or 10 years for the Russian land army to be ready to go again, just to physically create the vehicles ready to go again, let alone the personnel. Of course, there's more to an unarmed force than just the army. You've got the Air Force, you've got the maritime forces, the Navy forces, you've got the submarines, you've got your nuclear forces. Russia's submarine fleet is exceptionally capable. But if you look at what's happened here, if the Russian land army has been broken in Ukraine, if this is now the Russian long-range air force capability broken, that's two massive great chunks out of the Russian armed forces as a whole.
And while it's true that a quarter to a third of Russian long-range air force is far from a defeat of the overall Russian war machine, it is also true, as Major General Jonathan Shaw, who's the ex-assistant chief of the UK defense staff, told the BBC, this is a huge psychological turning point for Ukraine.
A lot of people were saying that Ukraine is finished, that America's pulled the plug, that Trump couldn't give a damn, and that Ukraine is therefore finished. What this is all clearly showing is that that's not the case.
That is right. It is a smack to the nose of Putin and a clear sign that Donald Trump was wrong when he chastised Volodymyr Zelensky in that Oval Office meeting with these words.
You're buried there, you're... People are dying. You're running low on soldiers. Listen, you're running low on soldiers. It would be a damn good thing. And then you tell us, I don't want a ceasefire. I don't want a ceasefire. I want to go and I want this. Look, if you could get a ceasefire right now, I tell you, you'd take it so the bullets stop flying and your men stop getting killed.
Of course, we want to stop the war.
But you're saying you don't want a ceasefire.
But I said to you,
I want a ceasefire.
With guarantees.
Because you'll get a ceasefire faster than an agreement.
Ask our people about ceasefire, what they think.
That wasn't with me.
For you what
that wasn't with me. That was with a guy named Biden who was not a smart person.
That was with Obama. It was your president.
Excuse me. That was with Obama who gave you sheets and I gave you javelins.
Yes.
I gave you the javelins to take out all those tanks. Obama gave you sheets. In fact, the statement is Obama gave sheets and Trump gave javelins. You got to be more thankful because let me tell you, you don't have the cards. With us, you have the cards. But without us, you don't have any cards.
Oh, no. I would say it's more the case that Donald Trump doesn't know the game. This operation took 18 months to pull off. What else do the Ukrainians have up their sleeves? Maybe nothing. Can Putin take that chance? Ukraine hit a key bridge in Crimea today, and Donald Trump says he had a call with Putin, who doesn't want to settle, except maybe settle the score, if he even can, which is being recalculated all over the world. Maybe even being rethought in the White House, though not knowing the score is often their calling card. And that's it for today's show. Michelle Pesca is CBSO. Corey Warr is the producer. Ashley Kahn is co-CBSO. Kathleen Sykes writes up the old gist list. Oh, you should check it out. It's very educational. Astrid Green does our socials and Leo Baum. He does a little bit of everything. Upru G Peru Du Peru. Thanks for listening.